From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! An environmental activist celebrates 100 days in a redwood. We'll talk to her in her 180-foot-high perch as she takes on Maxam Pacific Lumber. Cola wars and pouring rights, we go to Berkeley, California, to the latest battle against corporate control of the schools, and a look back at the worst massacre in Puerto Rican history. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton has reportedly decided to allow Cuban Americans to resume sending money directly to relatives on the island and to permit charter flights from the United States to Cuba in an effort to capitalize on a changed atmosphere in Cuba inspired by the visit of Pope John Paul II, this according to senior administration officials in the Washington Post today. In addition, the president will instruct the Treasury Department and other agencies to simplify licensing procedures for exporting medicine and medical devices to Cuba and to expedite the processing of license applications. The White House is expected to announce the changes today. They describe the president's decision, senior officials, as an effort to bolster the status of the Roman Catholic Church in Cuba and decrease the dependence of the Cuban people on state organizations. Clinton's decision marks the first relaxation of U.S. policy toward Cuba since Cuban jet fighters shot down two small planes operated by a Miami-based Cuban exile group in January of 1996, killing four crew members. President Bill Clinton faces protests from campaigners for a ban on anti-personnel landmines on his Six Nation visit to Africa next week. African Campaigns to Ban Landmines, a non-governmental organization working for the eradication of the mines, said in a statement it would call on Clinton to sign and ratify the convention on the prohibition of the use, stockpiling, production, and transfer of anti-personnel mines. The United States has been blasted internationally for declining to join 123 states that have signed the Ottawa Treaty banning anti-personnel landmines. The weapons are blamed for the killing of 25,000 people worldwide each year. In the second major human rights verdict delivered in Turkey this month, a provincial court sentenced five police officers to 7.5-year jail terms for beating a journalist to death. Human rights advocates said the sentences were far too light. The slain journalist, Metin Göktepe, was detained by the police during a funeral for two leftists in January of 96. Forensic specialists who testified at the trial said he'd been beaten and kicked and died of brain hemorrhage and internal bleeding. Officials of foreign governments, including the U.S., had said they were following the case closely and considered it a key test of Turkey's willingness to prosecute abusive police officers. The FBI is investigating a deadly fight at one of California's most violent prisons, along with allegations that guards at another of the state's high-security lockups set up brawls between prisoners. The fights at the High Desert and Pelican Bay penitentiaries were the latest to come under investigation by the FBI, which announced yesterday that it's widening its probe into the California prison system. A day earlier, eight guards from Corcoran State Prison pleaded innocent in federal court to staging gladiator-type fights between inmates of rival gangs. In a February 4th clash at High Desert in the northeast corner of California, 10 Asian prisoners attacked eight Latino prisoners in an exercise yard. Guards trying to end the fight shot and killed David Torres, a 29-year-old Latino, and wounded two other prisoners. The FBI is investigating whether the guards were justified in shooting Torres and may expand its probe to other disturbances at the prison. This news from Los Angeles. The federal government was sued yesterday over a law that makes it illegal to aid the lawful and nonviolent activities of foreign groups the State Department has deemed to be terrorist organizations. The lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court on behalf of six organizations and two individuals who want to continue helping two so-called terrorist groups, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, which seeks independence for Kurds in Turkey, and the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, LTTE, which advocates self-determination for Tamils in Sri Lanka. Court papers filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights claim that two provisions of the Anti-Terrorism Act of 1966 are unconstitutional. That's 1996. In the court papers, the CCR said the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals recently ruled that fundraising for the lawful activities of a foreign terrorist organization is protected by the First Amendment. The plaintiffs are seeking a preliminary injunction barring the government from prosecuting individuals and organizations under the act. Despite caution from the White House, talk of a possible impeachment probe is quickening in the House. House Republican Whip Tom DeLay used a floor speech yesterday to call the allegations against the president serious and say lawmakers may have to act. DeLay's remarks are seen as the bluntest yet on the subject of any member of the leadership. House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Judiciary Chair Henry Hyde said they're considering several possible responses should independent counsel Kenneth Starr refer evidence of possible impeachable offenses to lawmakers. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners.
Well, we want to wish a particular good day today to the person who is out in California who we're going to turn to right now. For the last 100 days, environmental activist Julia Butterfly has been perched 180 feet high in a 1,000-year-old redwood tree in Northern California. During the record tree-sitting protest, Julia Butterfly has withstood the heavy rains and blasting 60-mile-per-hour winds of El Niño's winter storms, as well as harassment from logging company Maxam Pacific Lumber, which has used searchlights and foghorns to disrupt her sleep. We now turn to Julia Butterfly, 180 feet up in a redwood. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Julia.
Thank you very much. Hello.
Well, first, hello. Can you describe where you are?
Where I am, approximately 180 feet up from the base of a over 1,000-year-old redwood tree, directly above the town of Stafford, California. I can see the town of Stafford, California, and I can see the Pacific Lumber Scotia Mill from where I sit.
And Julia, could you tell us a little bit about what led you to participate in this such an unusual protest?
It's a long story. It began in 1996 when I was in a car wreck that lodged my skull and almost took away. It made me have a problem with being able to walk and talk. And it took almost a year of therapy to make me normal again. And after that, I realized that, you know, I had almost everything that we take for granted taken away. And it made me think that I needed to be doing something different with my life. And I entered the redwood forest and was so overwhelmed by the beauty. And then when I found out that they were being taken away at an alarming rate, I knew that I had to do something. And so I got to the base camp here that was here in Stafford, California, and found out about what was going on. And they had this tree sit going, and they needed people to sit in it because it was getting close to the holidays, and everyone was leaving, and base camp was closing. And I was like, I can do it. I sold everything that I owned to come out here, and I have nothing but time and energy. And so I came up the tree, and that was the beginning of the story.
We're talking to Julia Butterfly, 180 feet high. Are you scared of heights by any chance?
No. When I was first climbing, it was a little scary, but that's when I first bonded with this tree that we call Luna, also known as the Stafford Giant. I just looked at the tree because this tree, redwood trees are amazing with the patterns on the bark. And this tree, being so old, there's lots of scars and lots of interesting patterns. And so I just looked at the tree instead, and I, at that point I lost my fear, and I've never had the problem again.
Hmm. And what about the storms? How are you holding up with El Niño around?
El Niño was difficult, and difficult, I think, is a gentle way to talk about El Niño. The worst storm, I had gusts up to 90 miles an hour. A branch from above broke off and collapsed part of my fort. A major branch that I used to get in and out of the fort was ripped off and blown away in the wind, and sleet and hail was coming through the ripped tarps. So it was pretty intense, but it was really an amazing experience to go through and be a part of with a tree, because it really kind of brings about a new understanding about, you know, what it's like to be a tree outside on a hillside like this that's coming under attack. And so made it through it, but it was definitely an intense experience.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about the methodology of tree sitting? I mean, are you always out exposed, or is there any covering for you when rain or other or storms like that hit?
Yeah, so this platform is a 6x8 platform. Then a major branch of Luna comes through the middle of the fort, and then there's a 4x8 platform that holds supplies, water, tarps, ropes, things of that nature. And so the 6x8 platform is basically the living area. But the whole platform is then covered in tarps. So normally, just in average weather, you stay pretty dry. But during the storms, the winds were so high that it was ripping the tarps and shredding them. And so that's why I was getting soaked in sleet and hail, because the tarps just couldn't stand up to that intense wind. But usually, like right now this morning, it's actually raining here. And right now I'm perfectly dry.
And what's it like at night there? Do you have folks who are providing you supplies who stay around the clock, or are you basically at night by yourself down there?
Most of the time up here I've been by myself. Sometimes there's people that come to visit. Recently there's been quite a few reporters, because it's become a media attention with my record breaking and everything else. But I have an incredible ground support crew, and they're what resupply me when I need food or whatever supplies that I need, they resupply me. But most of the time, it's been by myself.
Julia Butterfly, as you sit there 180 feet up, I'm sure you have a lot of time to strategize about what is happening there around the Redwoods and the battle with Maxam Pacific Lumber. Can you explain exactly what that is? And then we'll talk about what they've been doing to make it difficult for you to be up there. But can you explain what the battle exactly is about?
The battle is about a company, Maxam Corporation, run by Charles Hurwitz, that has come into this area and began completely destroying the environment and the lives of the people in these communities. The reason this sit is here in particular is because the town of Stafford below me, 7 homes were completely destroyed December 31st, 1996, as a direct result of the logging practices of Pacific Lumber under Maxam Corporation. And then there's the Headwaters Forest that currently is in the news with the proposal of the Headwaters deal that we are fighting every step of the way, because what they're doing is this man, you know, used his own savings and loans to purchase junk bonds and then failed the savings and loan. And so the U.S. tax dollars had to come in and bail out $1.6 billion. And so this man used part of the money from that high-risk junk bonds to hastily take over Pacific Lumber. And then he comes in here and he begins doubling and is now tripling the rate of cut of logging in this area and going back to the old techniques that have been proven dangerous and unsafe, not only for the environment but for people's lives, clear cutting. And so the problem is that he's coming in, he doesn't care about the forest, he doesn't care about the habitat that's in these forests, he doesn't care about the fact that he's cutting the last of the old growth, that we are left with less than 3%, and he is cutting the last of that at an alarming rate. And he doesn't care about the people's lives that he's destroying in the process. And so a lot of people in the local communities and from across the country and now around the world are saying, no, that's not right. You know, you can't take people's lives, and you can't take the life of the environment and base it on the dollar, because the quality of the life of our environment and the quality of the lives of our people are worth more than the dollar that's going into his hands. And that's where the conflict is coming.
We're talking to Julia Butterfly, who is protesting Maxam Pacific Lumber's cutting down of redwood trees. And she is 180 feet high in one of those redwoods in the Headwaters area. Julia, you have survived some amazing tests of courage and actually withstood numerous threats to your life during your protest. In December, trees were felled dangerously close to you. That was followed by aerial log removal by a Columbia twin-prop helicopter. What happened there?
That was That was pretty intense. They broke FAA regulations the very first day, trying in an effort to rip the tarps off and scare me down. And then when that didn't work, they just proceeded with their operations. And these helicopters they use because, in their own words, it is a gentler form of logging than cutting more roads into the hillside, because that is the road building, and then the clear cutting on this hillside is what caused the mudslide. So they're saying, okay, we're going to come in and helicopter log. But unfortunately, helicopter logging is no more gentle, and I didn't know that until I was up here experiencing it. And what it does, it has updrafts of up to 300 miles an hour, and it completely twists the tops and shreds the tops of these trees. Half of the trees on this hillside no longer even look like trees, the ones that are still standing, because the updraft has ripped them apart. Therefore, it's killed any nesting birds or any animals that live in these trees. They're gone now. And the updrafts are so strong, it's actually ripped some trees out of the ground. So these helicopters are extremely destructive to the hillside, and they basically, they pull the logs off of the hillside that have been felled, and a couple of times the logs have been very, very close when they're flying in the air to my front door, to my tree.
Now, what's been the attitude of the Clinton administration and that renowned environmentalist Al Gore to this situation? Could you tell us about what your view of how the federal government is reacting to this?
The federal government is standing up true in its typical way, and it's holding fast to the injustice of our justice system. The federal government has been a part of this Headwaters deal that is proposing to pay a thief. Charles Hurwitz is currently under investigation for the failed savings and loans, and two of the people that were involved with him in this takeover have already been convicted in federal court. So because Mr. Hurwitz has all this money, he's managing to stay one step ahead. But he's still in court being looked at for this failed savings and loan, the fact that he, you know, is basically a thief, stole the U.S. money, and is currently making millions off of it. So they're proposing to pay this already known thief more money for land that shouldn't be his to begin with. And then they're proposing a habitat conservation plan in this deal that allows the company to make their own habitat conservation plan, saying what's good for the environment here as well as for their company. But the Pacific Lumber has racked up 200 violations of the environmental laws, and yet this Headwaters deal says, "Well, that's okay. Go ahead. We're still going to trust you to write up a habitat conservation plan that will take care of the environment." And on top of that, then the habitat conservation plan only has to last 50 years, and then after 50 years, they're free to do whatever they want again. And that's really already is destroyed. Team habitat, they've destroyed, you know, the coho salmon, the marbled mullet, the spotted owl are all part of the habitat that we're fighting for, because they're all threatened and endangered, and the rates that Pacific Lumber is going, they're going to be extinct.
Julia Butterfly, Maxim ordered 24-hour to security to use searchlights and foghorns to disrupt your sleep. Was it difficult then? And also threatened to, or vowed to, starve you out until 20 people from Earth First hiked to the tree and nonviolently broke the blockade and resupplied you, which ultimately forced security to give up there.
Yes, well, it was really difficult when they were here, because they came right at the beginning of the worst of the El Nino storms came. And so they were doing the foghorns and the bugles, and they had dogs barking. They were, you know, trying to deprive me of sleep. And so sleep deprivation is actually a hard thing, especially when you're dealing with winter storms and trying to maintain a sit. But it was a great experience. All of these things to me are, you know, a good experience, because I've learned from them and I've found ways to withstand them.
Well, as we wrap up today, I understand that today, on your 100th day in the Redwood, that two groups will be honoring you. The Veterans for Peace will be presenting you with the Wage Peace Recognition of Valor, and the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee will be presenting you with the first annual Leonard Peltier Protector of the Woods Award. How will they reach you?
Well, there's going to be a rally in the town of Stafford at the base of the mudslide today, and they're going to
We're hoping that we didn't. Julia?
Yes?
Go ahead. And
okay. Yes, they're going to present it to my group, Earth First, on behalf of myself and on behalf of the forest and behalf of Earth First, that's working really hard to make a change here.
When do you plan to come down?
I don't know that. As long as I can continue to be a voice for these forests that can't speak, and as long as I can continue to be a voice for these people who should have been heard by the government a long time ago, I'm going to stay here. You know, what I've been through is small compared to what the people in these communities and what these forests are going through and what people like Leonard Peltier are going through. I'm dedicating the 15th through the 27th of my sit to him to try and have him released from prison because he's been wrongfully imprisoned for 22 years. So the things I've been through are small compared to the things that everyone else is going through that are involved with this government of power, lust, and greed.
Well, Julia Butterfly, we want to thank you for joining us. I understand you have a phone number and also a website. By the way, we're speaking to Julia on a cell phone up 180 feet high in her perch in the redwood called Luna.
Yes. You do have the information on the number in the website?
Do you have the website?
Yes, yes. Well, I wasn't sure if you were saying you had it or if I needed to
give
it.
Why don't you go ahead and give it?
Okay. I'm finding it here, all my information. The website number is www.northcoast.com/TildaSohum, S-O-H-U-M, /Luna. And that'll give people information not only on this tree sit, but on the Headwaters deal and all the information that's about.
And the phone number?
What's going on? 707 445-3344.
That's 707-445-3344.
Yes, and also if they can't reach through on that number, the same area code, 707-445-5105.
That's 707-445-5105.
105.
5105. Thank you very much, Julia Butterfly, and we do look forward to checking back with you soon.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Julia Butterfly, in trees in Headwater, California. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We move from one protest to another. When we come back, we'll find out about people in Berkeley, California, who are fighting corporate control of the schools. And then we'll take a look at the worst massacre in Puerto Rican history. Stay with us.
Take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to rulers. Yes, I think Julia Butterfly is knocking on heaven's door as she sits up there 180 feet high. Quite amazing. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, do you think you could do it?
Oh, no, I've got a problem with heights, Amy. Except on airplanes, I managed to get along fine.
Wow. Well, we're going to turn right now to another place in California, Berkeley, California, which has been at the center of a national debate over the role of advertising in the schools, is weighing a plan to limit corporate access to its children. The school board took its first look on Wednesday at a policy that would make sure that any deals between the schools and corporations would not require children to read, watch, or listen to advertising in their lessons or in the classroom. They also would not be forced to wear a company's logo or insignia on athletic uniforms or equipment. But still, critics are not satisfied. Berkeley High School is the latest school to be swept headlong into this national debate over the role of advertising in public schools. Soft drink giant Pepsi has offered to spend at least $90,000 at the school for the exclusive right to sell beverages in Berkeley High's vending machines for 7 years. The so-called pouring rights offer also includes a flashy new electronic scoreboard for the football field. The offer has generated heated debate in Berkeley and renewed interest in the role of commercialization in public education nationwide. We're joined now by two people who've been active around this issue. Marianne Manilov is executive director of the Center for Commercial-Free Public Education, which is a national group of parents, teachers, students, school board members, and administrators in 41 states working against commercialization and for public schools. She's based in San Francisco and also lives in Berkeley. Sarah Church also joins us. She's a sophomore at Berkeley High School. Why don't we begin with Sarah, and I want to thank you for waking up so early. What is your take on what's happening right now in your high school? What's this battle all about?
Well, I think it's about money, and that's a problem because the role of a school is to provide education. And while some people may think that this deal will help us in educating youth, I think we really need to be careful because the corporation's role in this, they're trying to make profit. They're trying to make money. If they wanted to help us give our students education, they would just make a donation. And because it's a business deal, they're about making profit. And when we make a deal with them, we incorporate their goals and their needs into what we're doing. And the school really doesn't need to be trying to make money right now. Trying to give students a good education is quite enough for them to be doing. And I think it's a mistake to enter into something where we capitalize the school.
Sarah, about how many students attend Berkeley High, and what's been the reaction among the general student body to this issue?
There are 2,000 to 3,000 students. It fluctuates very much, but there are lots of students at Berkeley High. We haven't taken any sort of poll, but there seems to be a healthy batch of both students on both sides of the issue. A lot of students are involved in sports. We have 32 sports teams, and the money would go pretty much exclusively to sports. And a lot of students are concerned that some students are being excluded from sports because they can't afford to buy the equipment or the uniforms required. And that's where this money issue comes in.
Marianne Manilov, I'd like to ask you, you're the director of the Center for Commercial Free Public Education. How widespread is this now, even in public high schools or high schools around the country, and why is your organization so devoted to trying to prevent the spread of commercialization in the high schools?
Well, the Pepsi deals are sort of just the latest part of commercialization in the classroom. And we've already seen, because we've been in operation for 5 years, where these type of deals lead us, because we're already seeing sponsored curriculum. On Monday in Oakland, there's a training by Nike, which actually is Nike training teachers to use Nike curriculum. And we're already
seeing... What do you mean Nike curriculum?
Well, Nike has just put out a curriculum this fall, which is essentially, it's an environmental education curriculum, and it ask teachers to spend a week with their students actually having them make a sneaker. And the purpose of this project supposedly is to show how many ways that you can use a recycled material within the life of a sneaker. And it's a week, though, of class time, and essentially what it really is a big PR for Nike at a time when it's coming under, you know, a lot of attack for its sweatshop practices. It makes making a sneaker seem like a simple crafts project. And Exxon has just announced 3 weeks ago that it's going to be spending $8 million training teachers in science. And this is not a company that we've not seen biased science materials from. Exxon, again, has very biased science materials about the Alaskan oil spill.
Just one quick comment on the Nike story. A friend was just telling me about the new slogan for Nike, sneakers being made for children by children.
Okay.
That's funny.
But back to Exxon.
So... the point is that it seems like just a simple scoreboard, and in Berkeley High's case, they would be taking advertising on the scoreboard, But I already spoke with the coach, the athletic director there, Joe Martin, and behind the Pepsi deal, he has a Reebok deal waiting. So this is a school that's looking at significantly getting involved with corporate partnerships. And I think Sarah, as one of the student members of the Student Awareness Committee, has organized a debate, and definitely the school and the community is really thinking about, do we want Pepsi to be the company that we get behind, which essentially they make caffeinated soda water? Is that something that we say, yeah, this is a great thing?
Well, Sarah, for Berkeley, which has long been the center of progressive politics in the United States, it seems to me almost beyond belief that anybody associated with the Berkeley Schools District would even consider this situation. What's happening with the school board there?
Well, the school board, as she said, just came out with a policy that would limit any funding that we got from a corporate or a private sponsor. There is something included that keeps them out of the classroom, keeps them from influencing our curriculum in any way, asking us to teach anything or not to teach anything, such as the labor practices in some other countries, and not influence the school's curriculum with the interests of the corporate sponsor. However, there are a lot of ambiguities in the policy and a lot of ways to get around it, and I'm sure that our athletic director, Coach Martin, will try in his best way to help the corporations do what they want to do with our school, regardless of the policy.
Why do you say that?
Well, he has showed that his interest is to raise money for the students so that they can play sports, and I think that that's a very good sentiment. I think that it needs to be looked at and tried. We should try to meet that goal where any student can play the sport of their choice in Berkeley High, regardless of their financial position. But I think that this is the wrong way to go. I think that his statement earlier that bake sales and car washes aren't working anymore isn't based in fact, because I have a couple friends who were on sports teams last year, and they raised a sufficient amount of money to buy themselves uniforms with simple things that they did themselves, with car washes, bake sales, garage sales.
You know, it's interesting because it goes beyond even the corporations, but when you have corporations just pouring in money, one of the things that those bake sales and car washes do is they build community. And they're about people working together and, you know, trying to raise money from the community, so getting community support. And when you turn to corporate control, these kind of rituals that we've all grown up with fall by the wayside. And it seems that you don't need to do anything to keep community together anymore, but turn to a corporation.
Well, I don't even think that these deals are about fundraising. I mean, I spoke with Coach Martin. I think he's new to the community. That's how this happened. And the Pepsi deal was about to be passed sort of in the middle of the night. And luckily, because the Berkeley community is so aware, they said, hold on, wait a second, what is this? And the contract was withdrawn from a school board agenda, and now we see the dialogue going on. So, and now the school board is beginning to say, wait, maybe we don't want to do this. And I think that's a good thing that's happening, and it's happened in Madison and Seattle. The entire city of Seattle has banned advertising in their schools and has a 200-member community group up there really trying to look at the school's financing because they're looking at a $30 million deficit over 5 years. And I think that's the larger issue, is that this is being proposed as a financial solution for schools, which is a complete joke. There isn't a school around the country that has met a major financial deficit or even made a significant amount of money in real terms by entering into these deals. The largest contract in the country we saw was in Colorado, and there they've earned it's $7 million over 10 years, which sounds like a huge amount of money, but it's a district of 88,000 students. When you do the math on that, it's about $7 a student per year, and that's not really going to even make a difference in any significant way in that community. But it's something that is a sign of desperation, and it's also a sign that these companies are coming in and taking people out to dinner and saying, hey, you just need to sign on the dotted line, and we'll get you some scoreboards.
We're talking to Marianne Manilov, Executive Director of the Center for Commercial Free Public Education, and Sarah Church, a sophomore at Berkeley High School.
Marian Maniloff, if you could tell us a little bit in terms of the, you've mentioned some of the cities and school districts that have resisted this effort, and what are some around the country that you see as especially troubling in terms of how they have gone along with, besides you mentioned Colorado?
And Colorado is, unfortunately, that's the worst situation we have in the country, where you have the most commercialized school in Colorado Springs, where they have billboards on the school walls and on the buses. And there, the superintendent, who I speak with fairly regularly, will say, you know, look, we haven't raised that, as much cash as we had controversy. But he hadn't had a bond measure passed in 13 years. Other places where there's a lot of commercialism include Texas, Florida, but really every school in the country has some form of commercialism now because of all these sponsored materials I was speaking about earlier, where you have Nike sponsoring a curriculum or Burger King doing something on nutrition. And essentially what we're doing is selling off our school day piece by piece. And I wish I could say that there wasn't a commercialized classroom, and I'm sure there probably are in some private schools, but we have citizens doing commercialism walkthroughs all over the country, and what they find is how much commercialism is already there. At Berkeley High, they're already looking at all their business partnerships and saying, what is good here and what is bad? And I think that it's something that comes in very quietly through the back door, and then all of a sudden it's one little deal, and then it's two, and it's three, or it's one sponsored curriculum that a teacher picks up, and then it's two and three and four, and all of a sudden we're losing class time.
Marian Maniloff, you mentioned Exxon, you mentioned Nike, we've been talking about Pepsi. What about other companies like Shell and DuPont? I understand they, too, are developing curriculum for the schools.
Well, they both, Shell and DuPont both have curriculum already. Shell has a curriculum which essentially asks students to learn about getting back to nature through driving there in their car or in their Jeep. And DuPont has one that is a three-part series. It's called Chemapalooza, and it's a sort of dancing, you know, MTV-style video series that tells students that we are all made of chemicals, that there's no difference between water or chlorine bleach. So the largest form of commercialism, though, is and remains Channel One, which is an in-school television program with 10 minutes of quote-unquote news and 2 minutes of advertising, which is broadcast to 8 million students every morning.
And that, I understand, in a number of schools, some of the rules on that is teachers cannot turn down the television volume either during the whole show, so that students really have to pay attention, or also they cannot turn down the TV during commercials.
Right. And there have been a number of protests, teachers and particularly students. Our organization was founded because students were concerned about it. And that's what interests me about this issue, is why students like Sarah are standing up and taking a position against corporations.
At Channel One, by the way, owned by Whittle, now apparently bought by ABC. Is that right, Disney?
No, it's not bought by ABC. Prime Media is actually the name of the company, and they're a subsidiary of Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts. It's a leveraged buyout firm.
Uh-huh.
You might remember the movie Barbarians at the Gate. That was about that company. So it's a very large company, and they're in partnership, though, with ABC. ABC is providing news to Channel One at this time.
Uh-huh. So they're making money from that.
And,
sure.
And Sarah, I'd like to ask Sarah, in the little time that we have left, if you could tell us, what about those who argue, hey, this is free enterprise, this is what America is all about, why should students be worried about corporations and free enterprise coming into the schools? How would you answer that?
Well, this is about, I'm sorry, what was the question?
That this country is based on free enterprise and capitalism, and why should students be worried about corporations coming into the schools?
Well, I don't think that a school is where free enterprise should be played out. I think that a school is about education, and that if anyone is going to be taking care of a school's financial needs, it should be the government. And if that needs to be through taxation of larger corporations, then that should be the way that it's done. But I think free enterprise has no place in the school because a school does not have a capitalist goal. It has a goal of education, and students should be able to get an education and not have to worry about how much money anyone is making off of their curriculum.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. And if you have a phone number or website you'd like to give out, you could do it now. Sarah Church, a sophomore at Berkeley High School, and Marianne Manilov, executive director of the Center for Commercial-Free Public Education, a national group of parents, teachers, students, school board members, and administrators in states around the country working against commercialization for the public schools. What is the phone number there at the center?
We have a 1-800 line. It's 1-800-UNPLUG-1.
1-800-UNPLUG-1. Well, thank you very much to both of you for joining us. That's 1-800-UNPLUG-1.
Thank you.
And Juan, by the way, since we were just talking to a student, I'm really looking forward to the graduation party. We're already making plans for you as soon as your college paper that you handed in after 30 years is accepted and graded.
Amy, I should never have told you about that.
But one other thing, will you bring that paper in when you get it back so that we can read it on the air?
Yes, I may actually offer it for the pledge period.
For listeners who missed it yesterday, Juan was very active, a leader in the Columbia strike in 1968. And, well, he didn't get his college degree from Columbia in New York then, but he has just handed in his last paper, and he may be getting it any day now if his paper passes. And we'll be keeping close tabs and hope to speak to his professor soon, who is still alive. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Yes, indeed, you're going to have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Maybe a rock and roll addict dancing on the stage, money, drugs at your command, women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor or they may call you chief. Gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
It may be a state trooper. It might be
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, the other night I went into a Barnes & Noble in New York City talking about commercial enterprises, but I went to get some books on Africa for President Clinton's trip there. And I was just pleasantly surprised to see that Angela Davis was walking in and about to give a talk. And at the end of her talk, the first person who got to ask a question asked her about political prisoners.
Okay, there are about 100 political prisoners still behind bars, including large numbers of Puerto Ricans who are in prison only because they are fighting for the independence or fighting against the colonial subjugation of Puerto Rico. As a matter of fact, I live about 15 minutes from the jail, from the federal prison, federal correctional institution for women, where Dilcia Pagan is being held, Carmen Valentin, Luz and Alicia Rodriguez, the other political prisoners there, Marilyn Buck, who was charged with helping Assata Shakur to escape, Laura Whitehorn and Linda Edmonds are there as well. So, yeah.
I just thought that was interesting to introduce this segment because people don't hear a lot about Puerto Rican political prisoners. She went on to talk about the Jericho March that is happening next week, Jericho 98, where people from around the country will be marching on the White House to demand that the U.S. government free all political prisoners. But very few people know about their history. And political prisoners who are in this country as a result of Puerto Rico have been fighting for independence and have been shaped by a number of seminal events in Puerto Rican history.
Yes, there are 15 Puerto Rican political prisoners still in U.S. jails, all of them for organizing and advocating and fighting for independence for Puerto Rico. But this is only the recent generation. Tomorrow will be the 61st anniversary of the Ponce Massacre. Actually, that's where I was born, in Ponce, Puerto Rico on Palm Sunday, March 21st, 1937. There was a peaceful protest of the members of the Nationalist Party of Puerto Rico, which was then the largest pro-independence party on the island. And the police tried to block the march and ended up opening fire. And when the smoke had cleared, there were, I think, 21 people dead and somewhere near between 150 to 200 wounded. And we have with us today Cal Wagenheim, who is the co-author of The Puerto Ricans, A Documentary History, and is also the editor of Caribbean Update, a monthly information publication for corporate business throughout the Caribbean and the United States. And I want to welcome Cal Wagenheim so we could talk a little bit about this almost totally forgotten incident in U.S. and Puerto Rican history, the Ponce Massacre. So I'd like to welcome Cal Wagenheim to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Cal, could you tell us a little bit about the events leading up to March 21st, 1937, what was happening in Puerto Rico at the time, and just who the leaders of the Nationalist Party were?
Well, I think it's important to understand the context and to remember that in 1898, which was just 39 years earlier, the United States had invaded Puerto Rico during the Spanish-American War and had taken over the island without a consultation with the people. And the United States installed a classical colonial regime at the time. A governor was appointed by the president of the United States. It was an American. He would be sent to Puerto Rico. The chief of police of Puerto Rico was an American. So you didn't really have any real form of democracy on the island. In addition to that, ever since the 1920s, Puerto Rico had been suffering particularly from the worldwide depression. It was a poor island to begin with, and the depression just caused even more misery. You had unemployment of 35 to 40%. Washington, unlike in more recent years where there have been, you know, some efforts at a war on poverty and some flow of federal funds, Washington was very stingy in that respect in those days. So in a sense, Puerto Rico was receiving nothing from Washington, either democratic power or any kind of federal benefits. So understandably, there was a tremendous amount of dissent, and you had some very dedicated, idealistic young men and women on the island who in some ways were even inspired in the 1920s by the example of the Irish Free State, the people striving for independence from England. And these were led largely by Pedro Albizu Campos, a young man from a poor family in Ponce who had gone to Harvard, graduated, I think, with some distinction up there, had actually served in the U.S. Army as an officer in World War I. But he came back and became a lawyer specializing in labor law and was convinced that nationalism was the one answer for Puerto Rico, that the Puerto Ricans had to become independent, just as really as a question of pride and dignity. So he began a series of protests and all kinds of activities. The nationalists were not pacifists. I don't think we should mischaracterize them. They were militant people. I don't think they were looking for trouble, but they were quite militant. There were some violent encounters between the nationalists and the police authorities in Puerto Rico, who regarded them as a threat, a menace. But then this, as you say, Juan, on Palm Sunday 1937, this was supposed to be just a parade in the town of Ponce. They had received a permit from the mayor of the town, but at the last minute this was canceled by the Puerto Rican insular authorities. It was really almost a provocation by the authorities to cancel this at the last minute. And the marchers just decided to defy the last-minute cancellation, and they began marching. And no one really knows exactly what happened, except no one saw any of the marchers with weapons. But suddenly a shot rang out. There was a tremendous fusillade of, bullets. And at the end of it all, a couple of police officers were killed also, but the great majority of those dead and wounded were defenseless young men and women and some children. So that's really what happened. The American Civil Liberties Union actually came in at some point to investigate at the invitation of some of the civil rights activists in Puerto Rico, and they concurred with the local civil rights activists that this had been a massacre. That's why it's called the Ponce Massacre.
Now, interestingly enough, the folks who were gathering at that very time, Pedro Albizu Campos and Juan Antonio Corregel and many of the other leaders of the Nationalist Party, were in jail because they had been convicted of a seditious conspiracy, and they were actually awaiting appeal. So this was actually a protest over political prisoners at that time for the freeing of the political prisoners then. In terms of the impact that this had on the island, because clearly for such a small island, the population may have been about 1.5 million at that time, to have this many people on one day wounded and killed, what was the impact on the island after that?
Well, I mean, it was a tremendous impact on the island itself. People were shaken up by this violence, and I think it also had an impact in Washington. I think in Washington they began to realize that all was not, all was not hunky-dory on this little Caribbean island, and I think they began to be concerned about it and began to put into motion some reforms. They began to try to transfer some of the New Deal programs into Puerto Rico to help alleviate the poverty there, and eventually put into motion a process that would lead to a greater degree of self-government in Puerto Rico. It would be 1946, I think, where finally the President of the United States appointed a Puerto Rican rather than an American to be the first Puerto Rican governor of the island. And then 2 years later, elections were allowed where Puerto Ricans for the first time elected their own governor and have been electing their own governor ever since. So, and then also a greater degree of autonomy was granted with a constitutional change in 1950. So I would say that the Nationalists, to a very important extent, by their pressure and their militance, this was a wake-up call for Washington. Washington did not grant independence, but it certainly budged and granted a much greater degree of political democracy, local autonomy, if you will, and began a flow of more federal aid to the island.
Well, you know, my family, as I said, came from Puerto Rico, and my aunts and uncles still recall, as children, the day of the Ponce Massacre and often talk about it, because after that, it sort of became, to be a nationalist in Puerto Rico was to be basically hunted, not be allowed to work in government jobs or as teachers. So from that period on, the repression increased considerably. Interestingly, this happened under Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Harold Ickes was the Secretary of the Interior at the time, the father of the currently well-known Harold Ickes. And Ickes was actually a member of the American Civil Liberties Union. Huh. So that even though the U.S. government and Congress did not investigate the massacre, the ACLU, as you said, did.
Juan, when you say nationalists, just to clarify for listeners who are not as familiar with Puerto Rican history, you mean those who won independence for Puerto Rico?
Right, the Nationalist Party. Right, everyone called them los nacionalistas, the members of the party.
Yeah, well, it was a particularly militant wing of the people who sympathized with for independence. There were others who were just called independentistas, who maybe were not nationalists, but the nationalists were a particularly militant wing of the pro-independence movement, and which was a far wider movement than, you know, a lot of people realize. At one point in an election in the 1940s, the Independence Party gained something like a quarter of the vote. The Nationalists were people who were willing to just stick their necks out and march and openly demonstrate, etc., because they were particularly adamant about gaining independence for the island.
The report of the ACLU that you mentioned, I have one of the quotes from that report by the committee was actually headed by Arthur Garfield Hayes, and it says, quote, "When we began our investigation, we objected to naming our committee the Committee for the Investigation of the Ponce Massacre. To refer to the Ponce tragedy, we used the Ponce case, the riot, or any other phrase that should demonstrate our intention of dealing objectively with the facts. Now that we have heard all the proofs, we agree that the people of Ponce had given this tragedy the only title it can possibly have, the Ponce Massacre." It turns out also that they note that the district attorney of Ponce at that time resigned rather than follow the orders of Governor Blanton Winship, the American governor at the time, and other Puerto Rican authorities to prosecute the protesters. In terms of the impact of Albizu Campos as a whole, because he was in jail at the time and spent many more years in jail, what became his impact as a figure in the history of Puerto Rico?
Well, I think today, just about everyone in Puerto Rico, whether or not they agreed with his extremely militant stance, views him as a figure of respect, because everyone, I think, acknowledges the fact that he was, you know, spurred on by very pure ideals to establish a country, that he was a brave man. Not everyone agreed with his methods, if you will. Some people, even those who don't agree with him, look at him as a kind of a quixotic figure, you know, tilting at the great big windmills of the United States, but certainly as a brave and idealistic man. And in a sense, he was, he and his followers were in some ways really victims of a much larger situation at the world level. They came on the scene struggling for independence at a time when the United States, in the beginning of World War II, was engaged in a worldwide struggle. The policymakers in Washington looked at any kind of turmoil in Puerto Rico as something that was disturbing the geopolitical balance in the Caribbean. And then after World War II, you had the Cold War, where again, any kind of lack of stability in the Caribbean was viewed as very bad in terms of Cold War politics. The United States had SAC Air Force bases on the island and a very large naval base. So in some ways, you know, the nationalists received not only, they were oppressed not only by the local police authorities, but the entire federal apparatus, the FBI, et cetera, also cracked down on them very harshly. The nationalists, in many cases, were jailed for not for what they did, but for what they said. There were very strict laws against what were called seditious speech. And Albizu Campos would make a speech, very militant speech, against U.S. colonialism, and there would be a police stenographer in the crowd who would take down these words, and then he would be arrested for seditious speech.
Well, Cal Wagenheim, we're going to have to close this session, but I really thank you for being with us. And we're going to be continuing our coverage. This is the 100th anniversary of colonialism in Puerto Rico. We're going to continue to be having other segments dealing with some of the history and the present situation in Puerto Rico.
That's right. And April 21st is the anniversary of the death of Pedro Albizu Campos, and we'll be doing more on him as well. Cal Wagenheim, co-author of The Puerto Ricans, a documentary history. Thank you for joining us. Folks, if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Jeremy Scahill is our director. Errol Maitland, our engineer. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. Monday, we'll be dealing with Africa. President Clinton is headed there with about 200 journalists and others. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York.